What's the future of food? In an era of manufactured meats and molecular gastronomy, you might think what we eat in the future will be determined by technology. But Taras Gresko argues that to plan our meals, we'd be better off looking backwards than forwards. Taras is the author of 7 nonfiction books and has written for The New York Times, The Guardian, and National Geographic. Here he is to share 5 of the big ideas from his new book, The Lost Supper, Searching for the Future of Food in the Flavors of the Past.
My name is Taras Gresko. I'm a journalist, travel writer, and author. In nonfiction books like Straphanger, Bottom Feeder, and The End of Elsewhere, I've explored the relationship between human activity and the environment. My latest book, The Lost Supper, Searching for the Future of Food and the Flavors of the Past, is a deep dive into our species' 300,000-plus-year-long relationship with the food that sustains us. Researching this book sent me on a round-the-world quest for ancient, lost, and endangered foods. It took me to a barrier island off the coast of Georgia, where Spanish explorers abandoned a herd of black-footed hogs, which had been fattening up on acorns for the last 500 years. It took me to the flanks of a volcano in the heart of Turkey, where a scientist showed me what he believes is a surviving population of a plant prized by Roman emperors for its intoxicating flavor. And it took me to the Yorkshire Dales to meet a farming family who were making the oldest name cheese in Britain from a breed of critically endangered cows. Today, I'm going to share 5 of the key insights that I gained along the way. Here's insight number 1. We can't actually travel back into the past, but thanks to recent archaeological and analytical advances, we may now be able to taste the past. For a long time, food historians were aware that the ancient world had a mysterious secret sauce known as garum. It appeared in almost every recipe in Apicius, the biggest compendium of recipes that survives from Roman times. In Spain, I met with a team of food scientists and archaeologists who used gas chromatography and electron scanning microscopes to analyze residue from amphorae recovered from the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in the year 79. Relying on original recipes and evidence from the organic remains, they were able to recreate this umami-rich sauce made of small fermented fish. Then they recruited top chefs in the city of Cadiz, Spain, to cook with their recreated garum. I got to sample some of their dishes, and the results were spectacular. I decided to try making my own garum. Under the guidance of a British expert in Roman cookery, I spent 3 months fermenting garum from Portuguese sardines. It's now become a secret ingredient in my own cooking. It brings savory intensity to all kinds of stews and pasta sauces. Making garum was a way of discovering how unfamiliar, but also how delicious, ancient cooking actually was. I realized the Roman mix of sweet, sour, and savory has more in common with Cantonese cooking than it does with modern Italian food. And here's what my experiments have taught me. When it comes to food, the secret to time travel is that humans alive today are identical in physique, intelligence, and problem-solving abilities to just about anybody who has lived in the last 60,000 or so years. When confronted with a problem, like how to build a shelter or assemble a meal, our ancestors drew on the same set of innate capacities that we possess today. The challenge is to see the world through their eyes. Once you know that, the only things you need to go back into the past are curiosity and imagination. Insight number 2. The best hope for food security in the future lies in looking to the diversity of the foods we ate in the past. Many people know that the world is undergoing a huge drop in biodiversity. Global heating, pollution, overfishing, and habitat destruction mean that the rate of species extinction is hundreds of times faster than it has been in the last 10 million years. According to some estimates, a quarter of the 8.7 million known plant and animal species alive today are likely to become extinct over the next few decades. What fewer people are aware of is the fact that agrobiodiversity, which refers to the range of plants and livestock that feed us, is also in decline. A tenth of the 6,000 or so breeds of domesticated animals used in agriculture are already extinct. Every month, a half dozen more are lost forever. The same is happening with traditional crop varieties. Since 1900, 3/4 of the genetic diversity once stored in farmers' fields has been lost. Now, if you go into a Whole Foods or Trader Joe's, loss of diversity might not seem a big issue. High-end supermarkets stock organic beef, microbrews, heirloom tomatoes, kale, and once exotic cereals like quinoa, amaranth, and spelt, foods imported from around the world. But behind this apparent embarrassment of riches, there's a poverty of real nutritional content. In the United States, 9 out of 10 gallons of milk come from just one breed of cows, the Holstein Friesian, all of which are descended from just two bulls. The majority of the world's pork production is now based on the genetics of a single breed of pig, the White Danish Landrace. The market for seeds, the ultimate source of all the world's crops, is controlled by just four multinational corporations. And half of the calories consumed on Earth come from just three grasses, all of them subject to either genetic modification or scientific hybridization: rice, corn, and wheat. Fortunately, there's hope for the future of food, though the solution might strike some people as being counterintuitive. When it comes to tigers, whales, elephants, and other endangered wildlife, the best we can do is spare them from predation and exploitation and give them the room they need to live. In other words, leave them alone. As for the ancestral grains, wild yeasts, and forgotten livestock breeds that have enriched the human diet over the ages, the way forward lies in reviving them, cultivating them, herding them, and consuming them. For those who champion the Earth's dwindling nutritional diversity, the message is as simple as it is urgent. To save it, you've got to eat it. Insight number three. In the not-so-distant past, humans ate a far greater variety of foods. The lack of diversity in modern diets isn't only risky for the future of food security, it's also bad for our health. In recent years, seed oils like sunflower and canola have replaced olive oil in Mediterranean nations, reducing lifespans in a region once synonymous with good cardiovascular health, leanness, and longevity. Around the world, the loss of diversity means a sharp drop in the omega-3 fatty acids, polyphenols, and other micronutrients essential for good health. The triumph of what some nutritionists call the global standard diet has also led to an increase in the diseases of civilization: hypertension, cancer, arthritis, asthma, diabetes, heart disease, as well as the complex of conditions known as metabolic syndrome. For the first time in two centuries, poor nourishment means children in the United States are expected to live shorter lives than their parents did. Now consider this. At a single 23,000-year-old site in Africa's Rift Valley, archaeologists have found evidence that Paleolithic foragers feasted on 20 small and large animals, 16 families of birds, and 140 different kinds of fruit, nuts, seeds, and legumes. One well-preserved early Iron Age man recovered from a bog in Denmark had 60 different plant species in his stomach, all of them eaten in the day or two before he died. Anthropologists have found that the Hadza, nomads in northern Tanzania counted among the last of the world's hunter-gatherers, consume 800 distinct plant and animal species. Yet of the 10,000 plants that have nourished Homo sapiens over the millennia, only 150 are cultivated for food today, and just 14 animal species provide 90% of the calories we get from livestock. Since the last two agricultural revolutions, the Industrial and the Green Revolution, we've cast our lot with monocultures of a few staple crops, with rice, wheat, corn, soybeans, and sugarcane at the top of the list. These monocrops have allowed the human population to increase to 8 billion, while leaving over 800 million of us chronically undernourished. The latest research shows that building diversity into your diet is crucial for good health. People who have a diverse diet. The latest research shows that building diversity into your diet is crucial for good health. People who have a diverse diet, which means they eat 30 different kinds of plants and animals a week or more, are significantly freer from disease than even people who eat an exclusively vegan and vegetarian diet. If this book has one message, it's this: diversity is resiliency. And that applies not only to the future of the world's food supply, but also to our own well-being as individuals. Insight number four. When it comes to ensuring food security, the gene banks we rely on as backup are cold comfort. What we need is diversity in the field, and to support that, we need diversity in our diets. All around the world, the crops and livestock we rely on to feed us are in trouble. On the shores of the Mediterranean, olive trees, some of them 2,000 or more years old, are turning black and dying, a victim of a disease called Salella fastidiosa. While researching the Last Supper, I went to the olive groves of Puglia in the south of Italy. I was shocked to see what's become of a landscape that goes back to the times of the ancient Greeks. The giant millennial trees are dying. All that's left in some places is forests of skeletons. And that's playing havoc with the global supply of one of the healthiest kinds of fats you can consume, extra virgin olive oil. Humanity's backup plan, unfortunately, is to keep the seeds and semen of plants and livestock in gene banks. There's a gene bank for olives in Cordoba, Spain, another for wheat in Morocco, for corn in Mexico, and the mother of them all, the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, which is located north of the Arctic Circle on an island halfway between the Norwegian mainland and the North Pole. The problem is that the seeds that are kept inert in cold storage aren't evolving with and adapting to changes in the environment. This is what I discovered when I went to southern Italy. Farmers there found that certain olive varieties were resistant to Xylella fastidiosa, and if you grafted them onto trees before they got sick, entire orchards could be saved. The same threat exists for coffee, whose habitat is being threatened by increased rainfall and heat, for grains, which can be wiped out by diseases like wheat rust, and for wine, as rising temperatures threaten the production of common grape varietals in Bordeaux and the Napa Valley. The best hope for such important species is to find what's known as crop wild relatives. Not only to find them, but to plant them, cultivate them, and yes, to eat them. Insight number 5. The quest for novel and intense flavors was and is a driver of physical and cultural evolution. There's a tendency among historians and anthropologists to push food and drink to the margins. For many scholars, food is filed away under the heading of energetics, the idea being, who cares what the workers who built the pyramids were eating? What's important to us is the lives of the pharaohs and the priests. I make the case that the sourdough bread and beer the ancient Egyptians ate, as well as the food that nourished the Maya, or the Hittites, or the ancient Khmer, is just as worthy of our interest as temple architecture and royal dynasties. The first time hominins used tools, as shown by the behavior of our chimpanzee cousins, might well have been to root out tasty grubs, ants, and termites. One of the most convincing explanations for why our species learned to master fire was that meat tasted so much better roasted than raw. Hunger and famine probably called the shots at many points in our story, but I believe that, ever adaptable omnivores that we are, the reason we bothered going over the hilltop or to the far side of the river was often to discover just how things tasted over there. Our spread as a species, in other words, was driven by our penchant for adventurous eating. Some historians and anthropologists, among them Jared Diamond and Yuval Harari, have made the claim that agriculture is the greatest mistake in the history of the human race. It led to pandemics, oppression, inequality, shorter lifespans. The Lost Supper makes the case that you can't blame farming for the ills of civilization. What we can say is that the way we're doing agriculture today is all wrong. We need to de-industrialize food production to preserve the health of the soil and our water supply. Doing so could slow down both economic and population growth. But given the signs of global ecosystem collapse we're seeing right now, that might not be a bad thing. There's one thing I discovered in my exploration of humanity's long relationship with food, from the quest for the long-lost Roman herb Sylphion, the pursuit of the ultimate cut of Spanish ham, is that flavor isn't a footnote in the history of humanity. Deliciousness is something that really, really matters. Researching and writing this book definitely changed my relationship with food and the way I cook for my two school-age sons. But in my opinion, an executive summary with a few bite-sized takeaways doesn't really do this particular book justice. The Lost Supper is an old-school travelogue, which means that part of the fun is joining me as I make my way to Mexico City, Vancouver Island, Savannah, Georgia, and Istanbul. Thanks for taking the time to listen. And for those of you who will be joining me on this journey, bon voyage! And bon appétit.
Thank you, Taris. That was 5 big ideas from The Lost Supper, Searching for the Future of Food in the Flavors of the Past by Taris Gresko. You might also like our book bite for Dinner in Rome, A History of the World in One Meal by Andreas Vistad. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.